This week, I'm going to be speaking to James Howard Kunstler. He's the author of The Long Emergency and Too Much Magic, which are the two non-fiction books of his, which we'll be focusing on. So, James Howard Kunstler, thanks very much for coming on to Hermetics.
A pleasure, James.
As it is, we're going to begin with the Hermetics question, the unique, but somewhat clumsy question, unique to this podcast.
I'll gird my loins.
So you can place three figures or thinkers, living or dead, within a room and listen in. Who do you pick? They don't necessarily have to be famous or real. It can be three of anything, really. And there's a conversation between the three and you get to listen in. Who do you pick?
I would pick Bonaparte, Richard Feynman, the American physicist, and Camille Paglia, the American polemicist.
Okay, that's very strange. I'm currently reading, actually, James Gleick's Genius on Richard Feynman. So that's a strange
coincidence. It's synchronicity, there. James.
Yeah, synchronicity. Did Feynman largely comment on it? I'm not too far in. I've read Feynman's biography. That was extremely funny.
I don't know if what he had to say about that bio.
Okay.
I'm not even sure that he was still alive when it was written.
No. Okay, so Bonaparte, Feynman and Camille Paglia. Is there a connection there for you?
Well, yeah, in a way. I'll try to explain it. They were all characters who very much went their own way. They were all people of high intelligence. They were all people who defied orthodox thought for the most part. And sort of carved their way through a lot of the bullshit of their own eras. And they were all very accomplished in their fields. Bonaparte especially speaks to an idea that I have about charisma, which is that basically there's a kind of declension of charisma. And it begins that with the people who are truly charismatic at the top, being characterized by knowing what they are doing. In other words, the most charismatic people are people who know what they're doing. Then just below them are the people who seem to know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And below them are the people who pretend to know what they're doing. And below them are everybody else, the people who don't know what the fuck they're doing.
And what would you say the percentage mixture of the West now is in terms of charisma? This charisma hierarchy. I like this theory.
Yeah, I don't think that you can state categorically what you're asking, except to say one of the most remarkable things that we're seeing in the United States and to some degree in Europe, two things. One is the collapse of the thinking class into a kind of idiocy and absurdity. And the other one is the notable and bizarre, mysterious, and strange lack of any kind of good leadership on the scene just about anywhere these days. But mostly I'm speaking of the West because I don't think it's necessarily true of China or Russia.
But they're, China specifically, their form of charisma seems to differ.
Well, it's a little hard. I mean, it's a cross-cultural thing. I don't really know how Xi is measured by his own countrymen, and I wouldn't venture to even try to suss it out. Putin presents a different picture. He's coming out of a culture that was deeply damaged for three quarters of a century. Mm-hmm. And the least that you could say about him is that he seems to have made a game effort to repair it and restore something like normality to his country. Beyond that, I might not venture for the moment, but under the circumstances where, we're really seeing the unraveling of technical industrial civilization in a kind of a slow motion train wreck, that's quite an accomplishment.
It's interesting that you say about a decline in charisma, because that implies there that
Decline in charisma. I mean, there's a decline of apparently capable, sensible, confident people who know what they're doing. It may be that the West being in such a generalized crisis of confidence has seen that insecurity spread through its thinking classes and its leadership so pervasively that it's reached an alarming stage. And, you know, I do think that these things happen periodically in history. You can see something very similar in the French Revolution, and especially the conditions that made it possible for Bonaparte to take over. You know, at the end of the, as the French Revolution was fizzling out in the 1790s, you know, the many of the participants had killed each other off for one thing, but the leadership was completely demoralized. And here comes onto the scene this 26-year-old cavalry officer who performs one act of questionable heroics on the streets of Paris by, you know, threatening to fire grapeshot at the mob. And he gets everybody's attention, and everybody turns around and says, "Oh my gosh, this is the last competent person in France, and you know, maybe he ought to lead the country." And then, by some amazing course of events, he ends up being indeed the leader of the country before he's 30 years old. So it's a very strange story, but what's especially strange are the conditions that led to the rise of Bonaparte. And of course, when he did finally get power, you know, it happened that he was an extremely competent administrator. Now, he had a very serious weak spot, which was his proclivity for making war and thinking that war was glorious and heroic and wonderful. And that was his undoing. But before he really went down that path and got lost in it, he was a pretty competent guy. And many of the reforms that he introduced are still present in French government and culture today, especially the basic body of its law.
So many might say with that comment that is this almost yearning for some form of competent leadership? Is this a reactionary standpoint in the present, or is it just an acceptance that these things kind of this lack of competence now is just part of a larger cycle that's ongoing?
Well, it's both, really. I think it is part of a larger cycle, but I do think that there is a yearning for competency that can address the very pressing problems that the human race faces. And what I said some years ago when I was still in the lecture circuit, and I've kind of come off the lecture circuit because the climate on the American university campuses now is so extreme and crazy that it's almost impossible to go to a university without generating some kind of a crisis, especially if you're retailing uncomfortable ideas, since the primary aim in American education now is to make the students comfortable. Mm. But what I used to tell them was, you know, when I gave my lecture was, we seem to be moving into a time when Americans will beg somebody to push them around and tell them what to do, mm-hmm. and give them some purposeful direction, because we have become such a feckless and purposeless nation, unable to address any of the important concerns that we find ourselves in, that, you know, it could be viewed as a kind of a fatal condition for the Republic.
So the lecture circuit you were in, you comment on this in, I believe it's Too Much Magic, where you go to the Google talk and you go to Google and give a lecture there, and they almost just cannot accept this. You know, they're basically kind of mumbled that they have technology. Would you put these lecture series along with contemporary Western education or the contemporary Western education system as a whole within what you just called the idiocy of the thinking class? Is that what you meant by that?
Well, yeah, pretty much. Although the thinking class, you know, in America, I would include the press, or otherwise known as the news media, including the TV news, and politics, and business, and science to some degree, and of course academia, and they're just you know they're as we say, as we boomers say, we veterans of the 1960s, you know, they all just seem to be losing their shit.
In what way?
In the sense that they're, you know, they have become preoccupied with ideas that don't necessarily comport with reality. And, you know, for example, the preoccupation with the tiny demographics of sexually confused people. You know, these have now become, for the left in America, the most important interest group to be served by politics. It's just preposterous. And of course, also a lot of the ideology around it does conflict with what we know scientifically about what constitutes sexual difference. So that's pretty nuts. The whole American Russiagate struggle or crisis or problem is a whole body of bad faith and dishonesty that has never been seen to such a degree in the United States. It goes way beyond any other scandal we've ever had or any other ideological conflict, including the Senator McCarthy struggles of the 1950s and Watergate and the Teapot Dome scandal. And, you know, it's really only comparable to the events that preceded the Civil War. So it's a very disturbing thing. And, you know, what you find basically is a very large cohort of people in the United States who ought to know better, who are acting as if they don't know better. So the whole picture is pretty depressing. I'm not sure how it's going to roll out, but I do think we are at the beginning of a ferocious reaction to that, and it's going to take the form of a lot of former officials going to jail.
Mm-hmm. So this completely touches in on the overarching thing here that we're kind of tiptoeing around the edges of, but without stating it in its kind of horrible, bastardized, contemporary chimeric name, which is progress. So this is all under the guise of progress. Perhaps what's happened to that word? Where did this form of progress come from? Where, you know, this exponential idea that things can always be better and under progress?
Well, for one thing, it's saddled with a number of assumptions that probably are not true. You know, one is that progress is limitless in the same way that the resources of the earth are supposed to be limitless, in fact, when in fact they are not. So that's one big problem. I correspond with a Mexican billionaire named Hugo Salinas Price, and he's somewhat of an intellectual, and especially a financial intellectual. But one of his theories about this I find rather interesting. He sees a parallel between the lunacy on the left in the USA and the religious practice that goes by the name of Gnosticism. That's Gnostic, Gnostic. Mm-hmm. And his main point is that Gnosticism is concerned with the transformation of human nature. In other words, the wish to improve the world by transforming human nature and making people into something that they are not quite being right now. In other words, perfecting. And, you know, I think that really does characterize a lot of the belief systems and behavior on the left. It's this wish to radically transform human nature as a way of making the world a better place. My own position is that we're unlikely to change human nature, and many of the artificial cybernetic methods that we're looking at for doing that, you know, whether they're artificial intelligence or some sort of mental or physical prosthetic that you bring into the human picture, you know, I think a lot of those are fraught with peril and we're unlikely to be perfecting human nature, in which case it's more a matter of improving our methods for just dealing with the ordinary vicissitudes of life on this planet. So that's what I would, that would be my program if I were a politician. But I think the explanation from Mr. Salinas Price is a good one.
Definitely. That's something I've been thinking for a long time, is that the leftists seem to have this unseen wholeness, and everything else that doesn't fit into it isn't of its own opinion. It's just incorrect and a fault in reality that should never have really been in it. They just can't really accept it. But if that's what you see the left as, you know, this, they're the focusing, you know, on extremely impractical tiny things, which much to the frustration of kind of, well, the majority. What do you see is going on in the right? In you know, is anything interesting going on in the right, or is it purely what we're seeing?
Well, I think there is something interesting going on the right because of what's going on in the left. You know, what is going on in the left is a new form of despotic, tyrannical behavior, this wish to punish people. I believe if you take a good hard look at the behavior on the American left, and I can't speak for the UK or the rest of Europe, but if you take a good hard look at the American left, what you see at bottom, really, beyond all the ideology, is just a desperate wish to coerce other people, to push them around and tell them what to do and how to think. And that, I find that to be tremendously disturbing, and something that the left itself doesn't seem to notice to be a problem. You know, they're taking on some of the worst qualities that we find in the tyrannical regimes of the 20th century, or even in works of literature like George Orwell. So that's terribly problematical. But one of the reactions to it is that it has bestirred this reaction among the right, which is sort of the rise of what's called the liberty left. Excuse me, the liberty right. And that's not exactly the same as the libertarian right, although they are related. But it's basically the idea that, you know, we are now in a situation where our civil liberties are so threatened by cranks, Puritans, witch hunters, inquisitors, and other dangerous characters who we've seen before in history, that it requires a new commitment to civil and religious liberty. It requires a new commitment to liberty from a loyal opposition. And I think that that's the best of what you're seeing on the right. There's also in the U.S., in which the right is represented by generally the Republican Party, you're just seeing a kind of a whole lot of fence sitters and characters who are laying back and not really participating and not really committing themselves to anything. They were probably largely a faction of not very principled people in the first place. And I don't know how long they're going to remain as an important part of the party. I think the surprising element of that reaction, though, to the despotic left, is that you haven't seen anything equal in virulence on the right yet. You know, you haven't seen the rising up of a really ferocious right-wing party that you know, really wants to go to war with these assholes on campus and elsewhere in politics. And, you know, I think if and when that happens, it's going to be pretty ugly. And it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, that's one of the things Douglas Murray said in his book, The Strange Death of Europe, which was, you know, if the left wants to see a real right wing, you know, all they need to do is keep doing what they're doing. There's kind of larger questions here regarding both progress and the politics, because there's a notion that you bring up, which the left has kind of been bringing, which is that 100% happy endings are possible. I mean, that's kind of a phrase for utopianism, really. But
absolutely right.
It covers up, you know, to have that, even that possibility, you have to start kind of putting, you know, cement over even concepts of death and impermanence and suffering, which as we know, and I'm sure you'd be sympathetic to agree, are, you know, that they're just completely parts of life, not only parts of life, but parts of life that you need to kind of get the contrast.
Life is tragic. You know, that, and it's interesting that is kind of a fundamental rule of the human condition that has been taken out of the college curriculum. You know, it's no longer taught on the campuses that, you know, life is tragic. And by that, it doesn't mean that everything is an unhappy ending. But what it does mean is that, shit happens and there are consequences to the actions that you take. And life is difficult for everybody, including the so-called privileged.
are we privileged? Do you consider yourself privileged?
Well, that concept almost didn't really exist until a few years ago. And oddly, it seems to come in the USA from a much older concept that you would have thought it would have come out of there sooner. But, you know, after the Second World War, the people who were not doing well in the society, especially the black and brown people, were labeled the underprivileged. And that label, you know, carried on for 30, 40 years. And it wasn't until, you know, decades later that all of a sudden somebody said, hey, if those people are underprivileged, the problem must be that the other people are too privileged. And that's where that came from. And, one of the things it shows you is the danger of using euphemisms to describe elements of the human condition. And you end up in just a kind of a hall of mirrors of ideology.
So what would you say was the problem there with regard to getting people out of their so-called underprivileged state?
Well, there are problems that we really don't want to talk about in the United States, despite all the fake calls for having a, quote, honest conversation about race. But we don't want to talk about, the failures of education. And, you know, I think what's basically gone on is this, is that now this is maybe an out of the box theory. But my theory, from having lived through the civil rights campaign of the 1960s, is that, that was a campaign that was taken on in good faith because the United States had won this war over tyranny and injustice and despotism. And we had styled ourselves as the beacon of the free world. And yet we were still practicing segregation and Jim Crow politics and racial abuse. And so we had a very sturdy campaign that went on for 20 years to correct those problems. And they climaxed in legislation in 1964 and 65. One of them was the Public Accommodations Act, which ended the physical segregation of people in public places, lunch counters, bathrooms, you know, all that, any public facility. And then the Voting Act of 1965, which made it much easier for people to vote in places where they had been deprived of the vote. And along with that came a great promise of transformation, you know, that that these civil rights victories would transform the life of black people who had been doing pretty poorly. Part of the reasons, there were many reasons for that. You know, one of the outstanding ones of the period was that when the mechanical cotton picker was introduced to the South, and it ended the practice of sharecropping, which is a kind of, serfdom or peasantry that the blacks were consigned to after the Civil War. Many of them came up to the industrial cities in the North to find work. And there was a tremendous promise of being able to rise in society, make a good living, make money, educate your kids, get a good job at General Motors, you know, and make a princely salary by the standards of the sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. So this large population of blacks moved from the South into, you know, up into Detroit and Chicago and Baltimore and, you know, all the small industrial cities of the Midwest. And then, you know, 15, 20 years later, all their work was offshored to other countries, and the factories closed down. And these people who had been deracinated once from their lifeways and homes in the South found themselves again in a crisis. And so that was a serious problem. But the civil rights era came along with all these promises that that their lot would improve. And it didn't improve as much as people wanted it to. And so what you're seeing 20, 30, 40 years later is the accumulation of a lot of shame and disappointment that the civil rights campaign didn't work out. And so there must be some other explanation for why it didn't work out. And that has turned out to be this thing called white privilege and structural racism. But, you know, what you're also seeing was this, that as early as 1960, the early 1960s, you began to see an oppositional black culture forming. And it was really kind of crystallized by the character known as Malcolm X in New York. But then the various student movements took it up, and Malcolm X was assassinated in the meantime. And the movement turned into a black power movement, so-called. And that became a kind of permanent oppositional culture for black America, which it has unfortunately been stuck in for about 50 years now. And among the shortcomings of that culture are the lack of interest in a common culture of the rest of the United States, and a lack of interest in some of the things that would make it possible for black people to do better in this culture. Namely, things like speaking English correctly, learning how to learn in school, and not writing that off as acting white. And so you end up with a lot of features of an oppositional culture that have been deeply unhelpful to black people in America. And they don't seem to recognize that it's not working for them. And right now they're getting a lot of assistance. They've always had a lot of assistance from the white liberal left, but they're basically being encouraged to just keep doubling down on what they're doing, and it's not working. And the liberal left, I believe, is consumed with this shame and disappointment that they can't articulate and that they refuse to confront. And so, as is the case with many kind of psychopathologies, it ends up being expressed in a pretty destructive way and a pretty unhelpful way. So that's the long story of what I see about the problems of the very poor in America, but in particular black America. Now, white America, especially white former working class America, has begun to join the oppositional culture. Well, they're developing a different kind of their own oppositional culture, which is, based on basically dropping out, being idle, taking a lot of drugs, being violent, and the failure to recognize a lot of boundaries, like sexual boundaries. And, so it's become equally problematical. So, mm-hmm. So there you have it. You know, it's kind of as a whole, if you can even call it a whole, because it's mostly an admixture of various parts, American culture is really in free fall, and it's deeply disturbing. We don't want to talk about any of the real reasons for it. Like, the kind of things that I discussed 5 minutes ago would be absolutely verboten in the USA. If you said anything like that on Twitter, you'd be considered, some kind of a terrible bigot and racist, but it's simply a recognition of conditions that we're seeing now. I do want to say one thing that about what you asked me earlier, mm-hmm. and it has to do with why the ideology of the left has become so untethered to reality. And it was really the basis of my 2012 book, which was called Too Much Magic. And I think that we have entered a culture of wishful thinking. And, it's a phase that we're going through in history. It's an unfortunate it's an unfortunate set of beliefs and ideas and behaviors, but nonetheless, we're doing it. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we are probably secretly very worried about where history is taking us right now. And it's not very well understood by the public at large, especially the economic and financial issues. And so a great body of wishful thinking has grown up around ideas that will allow us to think that we can keep living the way that we're living now indefinitely. And that's really the basis of it. We probably can't keep living this way. A lot of it has to do with our energy supply, about which there is a good deal of dishonesty and bad faith also. But we're probably going to be faced with some epical changes, and we don't want to face them. So we're immersed in these wishful thinking patterns of behavior.
That actually connects to the question I want to ask you. Kind of, you made a brief comment about it actually in Too Much Magic, and you note that kind of in what you call the long emergency. You know, what I would say that kind of this is the same as what John Michael Greig calls, you know, the long descent. This kind of slow. It's not a collapse. It's a very slow process of. It's a long emergency, like the we're within. But we're ignoring. But back to this kind of culture where you say white people are kind of dropping out and doing a lot of drugs. I mean, this has become quite a trait, probably from 2000 onwards. You know, postmodernism, irony, hipness, and you state that in Too Much Magic that this form of culture, this form of kind of idle, fruitless, you know, hipness and irony is going to be so abhorrent within the future. I just wondered if you could comment on why you saw it that way.
Well, what you're seeing is a culture that is purposeless, but especially in terms of a personal sense of purpose. People don't have that. Most Americans do not like their jobs or actually hate their jobs. Most of the places in the United States where people live are terrible environments. I wrote about all that in my first nonfiction book, The Geography of Nowhere, about the fiasco of American suburbia and how punishing it is to the human spirit to and also punishing economically to be immersed in that entropic pattern of existence. And we are entering a period of history where life is going to be much more difficult and challenging. You know, remember, or bear in mind that we're still fortunate enough, I suppose, to have access to tremendous comforts and conveniences right now, because the techno-industrial economy is, for the moment, still humming along. Mm-hmm. But my hypothesis is that it is going to collide with certain economic realities that are going to prang it, and that we're going to find ourselves in very different circumstances in, you know, 5, 10, 20 years that will require people, will compel people to be much more serious and much more earnest and much more purposeful. And if they don't, their lives may be at stake. They're going to have to work harder at things that are meaningful. And a lot of these things are going to surprise the public, especially the younger generations. For example, I do believe that many members of the younger and youngest generations are going to find themselves working in one way or another in agriculture, mm-hmm. in 20, 30, 40 years. The survivors will anyway. And, you know, they find that probably absolutely impossible and unbelievable. And, you know, we don't want to have any conversation about that. But the Western world, well, the world generally, the people of the world are going to have a much harder time feeding themselves when we don't have a fossil fuel based agribiz form of food production in the world. I think it ought to go without saying that we will probably endure famines and, you know, very serious disruptions.
Yeah.
By historic measure, there'll probably be worse than anything the world has ever seen, just because of the sheer numbers of human beings that are now on this planet. And many of them aren't going to make it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's going to be a tougher scene, but it will be probably self-correcting in its own punishing way.
Just to put it into perspective, for when you mentioned about, you know, kind of fossil fuel powered agriculture, I think my statistics are correct when I say that for, you know, meat, mass-produced meat-based food production is, I think, almost 70-1 calories in to,
calories,
yeah, out. And then vegetables, yeah, is about 13-1. So those are the ratios for anyone who doesn't know. But when you talk about the herd, you know, the kind of the things that are going to prang progress, of course, which also for anyone who doesn't know, I think the we have to maintain a 3% growth year in, year out for the entire thing not to fail.
Yeah, especially financially.
Yeah. So the thing that, you know, the things that are going to prang are, of course, the finite. And, of course, I'm going to speak of oil here because that's the peak oil here because that's the clearest one. I think most of the listeners can look up the theory of peak oil themselves. But what would you say to the naysayers of peak oil? I would say that they're just hoping on a, you know, Deus Ex. But yeah, what would you say to those?
Well, there are a lot of them. In general, I think you can say that an awful lot of serious people no longer believe that there is such a thing as peak oil. And a lot of that is a result of the so-called shale oil miracle in the United States. Now, you know, the shale oil miracle is based on a recovery and production process that is hyper complex to even an extreme of hyper complexity. And it is also an endeavor in which just about none of the companies involved are making any money. And it has all been performed through the miracle of zero interest rate or near zero interest rate financing. And the problem now is that the companies have had 10 years to demonstrate that they can produce a lot of oil and not make a profit at it. And the problem with that is that they are unlikely to get the kind of financing that they need to continue their operations at the scale that they are still operating at, which tells me, first of all, the shale oil, the whole shale oil endeavor was a kind of a financial stunt and technological stunt. It was very impressive, but I think that it is going to fall apart as quickly as it shot up. You know, remember, we went from in the United States from producing under 5 million barrels a day and importing something like, 15 million barrels a day to now producing 12 million barrels a day. And now I think we import something like 3 or 4 million barrels a day. So yeah, we're importing less. We are not energy independent. But the rise of that tremendous rise to a new American peak, production peak of 12 million plus a day is happened so quickly that I believe that on the downside of it, it's going to happen equally quickly and be a really crushing and disrupting disappointment for this country and for the world.
Can I ask if you have specific dates at all?
Well, about all I could really commit myself to is saying that, look, the shale oil miracle shot up from like 2008 to 2019. It's basically been a, you know, 10, 11 year arc to that thing. I can see it falling apart more quickly than it went up, which means less than 10 years, because once things really start unraveling, they tend to go down faster than they went up. I mean, that's certainly true of financial markets. And it's probably going to be true in terms of shale oil production. So the bottom line is that America got a reprieve from worrying about their energy supply for 10 years, mm-hmm, due to what turned out to be a impressive financial and technological stunt. It's important to remember that, well, it's important to remember that this near zero interest rate kind of financing was itself a tremendous anomaly in human history. And, you know, we don't know what the outcome of it is going to be, but what it really represented was a tremendous borrowing from the future. And you can only borrow from the future so much before there's no more future left to borrow from. That's the conundrum that we face.
Speaking of the future, you have this great quote in Too Much Magic, where you say, kind of in a future where the long emergency is kind of well underway and people have, at least the surviving probably 10-20% have accepted it and they're well underway, you know, living the way they now need to live. You say, we will not be consumed by our consumption, nor will our children or grandchildren. Now, outside of the contemporary lusts for consumption and for, you know, for objects and detritus and silly little items, is this a kind of fake nostalgia for some kind of Wendell Berry-esque farm living, which Tish to play devil's advocate would go kind of hand in hand with the tongue-in-cheek jokes you've been making about yourself being from the boomer generation, or is there a very sincere replacement to the culture of consumption that we're currently within and have been in for the last 60 years?
No, it's dead serious. You can't have a culture of consumption if you don't have a culture of production to accompany it. And if we're going to get into trouble with fossil fuels, which we are for sure, mm-hmm. we're simply not going to be able to produce the amount of stuff that we need. And that includes things like home heating and air conditioning and just the conditions that make it possible for people to be as comfortable as they are in this advanced civilization. But it also extends, of course, to things like food and tools and just about any other produced, manufactured good, you know, whether it's furniture or books or artwork or, anything. Mm-hmm. So I think we're really talking about is we're just going to have a whole lot less, and we're going to have to find a way to live with a whole lot less. And, it's liable to be pretty difficult. The real question for me is, how does human society reconfigure itself in order to get through or to live in that under those conditions? Mm-hmm. And my best guess, based on the scenarios that I laid out in my four novels that went under the rubric of world made by hand, and they were set in a post-industrial collapse United States, you know, I think we're going to see something that resembles neo-feudalism or kind of a neo-medieval society, if we're lucky, if we can keep it together. One of the differences, one of the reasons this is not really a nostalgic thing, we have to consider the fact that the kind of resources that were available in the world in, 1300 or 1500 were considerable compared to what's left today, whether it's, timber or ores or coal or, any useful resource that the world offers to us. And there are things that are going on now that are quite scary in terms of the ecological damage that we've already incurred, things like the disappearance of insect populations and wildlife and birds. And these are things that are pretty ominous, and we don't know where that's taking us. Although when I wrote my novels, I came to the conclusion that nature is resilient. Nature does mm-hmm. bounce back. And, mm-hmm. When the human race, is forced to give up many of its depredations on this planet, that a lot of the other creatures will bounce back. But it's still, what I said about the resources and the ores and the timber and all that stuff, that's going to still be very problematical. The conclusion you could come to is that one way that can only work will be if there is a much smaller human population worldwide.
And that this culture of consumption, you say it kind of climaxed in the 1970s. So from 1970, so let's say, going off the estimates you mentioned previously, to say 1970 to say 2040, what do you think people are going to look back and see that era as, this era as?
Well, hard to say. I think the capacity for nostalgia is enormous, and there will be an awful lot of things that people miss. You know, I'm quite sure that people in Dixieland will miss air conditioning. You know, Dixieland, that is the southeastern states in the USA, was kind of an agricultural backwater up until about 1960. And it's no coincidence that the rise of southern cities and the rise of southern business culture and its commitment to the global economy was that it happened largely because of air conditioning. And it made it possible for people to live in these places, which were really quite uncomfortable places to live otherwise. So, they'll probably be returned to becoming agricultural backwaters in the future. And people will, you know, sit back and think nostalgically about the days when they could just sit in the air conditioning and watch television and be comfortable. That one of the things I noticed about the South, because I traveled around the South a lot when I was doing college lectures for 20 years. And it interested me that they were so destructive to their own towns. And it was in part because they had very little nostalgic for their own past. You know, they were not nostalgic for working, doing hard agricultural labor in the heat. They were not nostalgic about getting hookworm from walking around without shoes. They were not nostalgic about eating shitty food, although they still eat a lot of shitty food in the South. But, really shitty food like pig snouts and, you know, hoofs and whatever other crap they were eating. And, in short, they didn't have any nostalgia for their past in that sense. They had nostalgia for the present. They were deeply committed to the culture of, you know, air conditioning, night baseball, cheap snacks, motoring, all the things that make up the matrix of contemporary American life. They were deeply committed to that, and they were not committed to their own history. But they're going to find themselves back in that uncomfortable history, and it's going to be interesting to see how they cope with it. Mm. Just saying.
You've commented a couple of times now on the work that we're going to have to kind of go back to. You know, people, there's not going to be filler jobs anymore. The jobs that Dmitry Orlov calls the embroidery on the fabric of society, you know, marketing, things along those lines, where when you pull it, once you've pulled it apart, there's nothing left. Whereas you pull apart a farming, you know, what are they doing? They're farming food to eat, you know, there's still something there. Is this a boomer yearning for the younger generations to finally all pull up their bootstraps?
Well, it's hard to say how much it may be tinged by that. I don't really know, because, you know, one of the things about me is that I don't happen to have children, despite being married more than once. I just didn't produce any children. So unlike some of my other contemporaries, I'm not really communing on a daily basis with millennials. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not really tracking their woes and sorrows and joys and, you know, what their experience is like, although I pay attention as much as I can to what's around me. I'm saying the things I'm saying because I think that they represent the destination of this journey that we're on, at least the next stop in the human project. And I think the next stop is going to be a timeout from techno-industrial progress. It may be a very long one. It could even conceivably be a permanent one. We don't know yet. But I think that's what we're heading into. And a lot of the assumptions, getting back to the main core of what we've been talking about, a lot of the assumptions about how we are living now and how we're going to live in the future are based on the idea that techno-industrial civilization just keeps on chugging along. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that. I think that it is a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. and we're closer to the end than we are to the middle. And when that happens, it's going to incite a whole new regime of thinking about what human progress really was. And personally, I think that the techno-industrial regime, which I would date back, you know, if I had to date it, I'd just say, well, from about 1800 on, you know, I think that will prove to have been a historical anomaly. And historians further into the future, when sitting around their campfires, will regard it as a historical anomaly and not necessarily a permanent installation of the human condition.
And this destination that we're heading towards, which do you have any somewhat clear advice for generations who are going to be experiencing it firsthand?
Yeah, I would say learn as many practical skills as you can. There's a lot of information out there right now in books, and even while we still have it, the internet, YouTube, et cetera, plenty of how to do this and how to do that. There's just tons of it. I think that young people need to make a very thoughtful calculation about where they're going to live, because there are going to be some parts of the now inhabitable world that are going to be different in one way or another, or even if they're the same, they may not be habitable under newer conditions. Like in the USA, the southwestern cities of the USA, like Phoenix and Tucson, and even Los Angeles, are places that are unlikely to thrive in the future for practical reasons. You know, it's not easy to grow food in Tucson and Phoenix. In fact, it's quite difficult. It's the desert. And their water supply is an artificial water supply. You know, they're dependent on motoring. None of those conditions are going to all of those conditions are going to be challenged. So people who think they're going to be able to live in Phoenix, Arizona, better think again. As far as Europe goes, well, for one thing, we really don't know. It's hard to say what is going on exactly with the climate and exactly where it's taking us. You know, I wrote in those two books that you cited of mine that, you know, we might be concerned about what's happening with the Gulf Stream. That might be a harbinger of colder times for Northern Europe, probably making it much more difficult for people to live there in large numbers. So we don't know. Those things are up in the air, but millennials would be well advised to think carefully and long about where they're going to live. So where they're going to live, what they're going to do, what kind of ideas they're going to adopt, how they're going to preserve much of the knowledge that we already have that's liable to get lost. You know, another strange feature of the time we live in is the assumption by apparently a lot of people that the internet is also a permanent installation in the human condition. And many of those people who believe that don't seem to be paying attention to how fragile the electric grids are in various parts of the world, including the United States. And, you know, if you don't have dependable electric power, you're not going to have much of an internet. So, don't necessarily assume that is now, you know, part of the human condition. I have no confidence at all that we're going to become a world of automation and robots and AI. I don't think we're going to get to that. I think we're going to lose our shit before that happens. And it would probably be a good thing if we did.
Unless there's anything you feel that we could have touched on, or anything you don't often get to comment on that you'd like to speak about?
Well, the only thing that I have to say for myself is that, you know, I've been concerned with issues that are very scary to a lot of people and in some cases even offensive. They're difficult issues to grapple with. They're pretty fundamental to what's going on with the human race right now and our ability to carry on this project further into time. Personally, you know, I'm not a depressed person. I'm a pretty cheerful guy. And I've found a way to find meaning and purpose in my own life, even under ominous conditions. And I urge other people to understand that that the joy of just being here on this planet is going to continue. You know, life may be difficult, but we're going to find reasons to live and purposes and things to believe in and things to be joyful about.
Are you a religious person at all?
Not in the least. I was raised in a religion-free household, and I don't have an animus against religion particularly. There are elements of it that I'm kind of an opponent of. I'm not into inquisitions and, you know, witch hunts and other things like that. But I'm not against them. But I have managed to find my own purpose and meaning in life without becoming immersed in pre-cooked belief systems.
I think that's a good place to stop. That's all right. Thanks very much for coming on.
You're quite welcome, James.